Right. Maybe not what you're expecting to start this morning. Now, the scenes that you see there in the music video is part of a very special movie. And that movie, of course, is Free Willy. All right? Just hands. Who has seen Free Willy? Oh, good, man. And if you haven't, wow, are you missing out. Let me tell you about this movie, okay? This is a movie about an orphan boy and his orca, okay? It's the story of a young boy, Jesse, who's had a difficult life. He's trying to adjust to his new home. And it's also the story of this orca, Willy, who was kidnapped as a little baby orca from his family by whalers and sold to this amusement park. And against all odds, the two meet, and they form this connection, this bond between each other. And Willy, he had always been difficult and uncooperative. He wouldn't perform the tricks at the amusement park, and so he was really worthless. He was a drain on resources for the park. But for Jesse, Willy will perform. And so he'll raise his flipper on his side, like you saw, and he'll do the jumps, and he'll take the fish from Jesse's hand. And so Jesse is actually given a job at the park as Willy's trainer. And everything is kind of coming together. Like, life is starting to get good. It's starting to work out for Jesse. But then one night in the park, after everyone's gone, he hears something out in the ocean. It's Willy's family. And they're calling for Willy. They miss Willy. And Jesse realizes how miserable Willy is, stuck in captivity. And there's even this physical sign on Willy of his captivity. You see, when an orca is in captivity, their little dorsal fin that's on their back, it kind of flops over and doesn't happen naturally in the wild. Now, even worse, Jesse also overhears that the owner is planning to kill Willy to collect the insurance money. It's very dramatic, you know. So things are looking bad. So Jesse and his family, they come up with this plan to, you can guess it, to free Willy. And they sneak him out of the park at night. They drive him to the ocean in the back of this truck. But the bad guys are already there. They're blocking the exit from the marina with these boats with big nets. And so in this final climactic scene that you see on the movie poster, Jesse has Willy do his largest jump ever, and he sails over Jesse. And man, when I was 7 years old, I thought it was the coolest thing I've ever seen. When I watched back over it, it's like the worst CGI that I've ever seen. But Jesse soars over, sails over the rock wall to freedom. Now, like I said, I was 7 when this movie came out, and I thought it was the best thing ever. I just thought it was great. My friends and I talked about it. We pretended to be Willy and Jesse, all that stuff. But maybe I should have shared that. But something really interesting came out of this movie. You see, this was a movie about the evils, the moral wrong of keeping an orca in captivity. But guess what? This movie used as one of its actors an orca that was kept in captivity. And so the orca that actually played Willy was named Kiko. Now, children who, like me, had been enthralled by Willy's story, they wrote in asking for Kiko to be released, to be set free. Over 7 million children wrote in letters. It was a big deal. And so it began to happen. Money was raised, foundations were formed. Over the next few years, over $20 million would be raised to set this orca free. And so over those years, Kiko was prepared for release, for freedom from captivity. Because you couldn't just set Kiko free immediately. Kiko had to learn to hunt for food, to avoid danger, how to live alongside other orcas. And finally, the time came. The time came to be released, and Kiko followed this pod of other orcas out to sea. But the story doesn't actually have a happy ending. You see, Kiko showed up a month later alone, without other orcas, and he was seeking out humans. See, even though Kiko was free, he was unable to reintegrate into wild orca society. And so he returned seeking out the people who had imprisoned him. He returned looking for the comfort of the walls that had kept him enclosed. And Kiko died a year later after he returned to captivity. And that is really the nature of captivity. That captivity is not just about being physically restrained. It changes who you are inside. It breaks you down, and you come to prefer the walls of your prison instead of freedom. You come to appreciate the values of your captors and disregard your own beliefs. We started looking a few weeks ago at the book of Daniel, And there we found an identical situation. There was the kingdom of Babylon. It was this powerful, wealthy, beautiful, advanced kingdom, the strongest kingdom in the world, and it was violent. And they came down to the smaller kingdom of Judah and destroyed it. They reduced Judah to rubble. Even God's temple was destroyed, wiped out, people were killed. But amidst the ruin and the death, Babylon looked out and saw potential, saw opportunity. And so they decided to leave the best and the brightest Jews alive and take them back to Babylon for re-education. And so these Jews, they learned the Babylonian language, they adopted Babylonian values, and they got Babylonian names, and they were encouraged to leave behind their silly, ignorant beliefs and values. And Babylon brainwashed them, changed them. Now, four of those taken were Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we get to see in the book of Daniel how they deal with this re-education, being captives of Babylon, surrounded by a culture that is averse to their own values. And their story is so valuable to us today, because like them, we're captives. We're captives of Babylon. Babylon is not just a place, it's a philosophy, it's a culture, it's a way of thinking. And we live in our very own Babylon. We're inundated with people trying to brainwash us. They want to, you know, control how we spend our money or where we invest our time or what we care about. And don't you know that your beliefs about God and sexuality and right and wrong and the purpose of life, they're old, they're outdated, they're antiquated. So why don't you just get on board with Babylon? And so when we read the book of Daniel, it's natural for us to ask the question about Daniel and his friends, will they stay true to God? But the book of Daniel, it turns around to us and asks us a question back. It says, will you stay true to God? And by reading about how these four men in the book of Daniel handle the pressure and captivity of Babylon, we can learn a lot about how to respond to Babylon today. So if you haven't already, please turn over to Daniel chapter 3. That's going to be our text for this morning, where we're going to kind of spend our time. Now, as you get into Daniel chapter 3, there's going to be someone who is conspicuously missing, and that is the namesake himself, Daniel. He's not in Daniel chapter 3, but if you look back at the end of chapter 2, you'll see that Daniel has interpreted this dream for the king, and the king is so pleased and so appreciative, he promotes Daniel to be the second person in the whole kingdom. He's Nebuchadnezzar's right-hand man. And in turn, Daniel then elevates Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be provincial officials. And so this account here in Daniel 3 is all about them, all about Daniel's three friends. And Daniel seems to be back at the palace handling business, while Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come face to face with the pressure and power of Babylon. So let's read verses 1 through 7 of Daniel chapter 3 here. Verses 1 through 7, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and people of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, this sets the stakes pretty well for us. We see the conflict coming. We don't know exactly how long Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have been in Babylon at this point, but from chapter 1, we know that their training took 3 years. So we know they've been there at least 3 years, probably quite a bit longer. Now, scholars will tell you that they were likely very young when they were kidnapped, around the age probably of 16. And so the point there is that a significant portion of their lives and pretty much all of their adulthood has been spent in Babylon, undergoing re-education and serving the king. They may have forgotten most of their former lives, what home looked like, the faces of friends and family now dead. But one thing has stuck with them through it all, that long ago Moses was given these stone tablets upon which God had written 10 commandments, and they have kept those commandments close to their hearts. The first one, you'll have no other gods. And the second, you cannot make an idol or image and bow down to worship it. And in spite of the training and the teaching, the constant barrage of values and manipulation, they have kept those truths alive in their hearts. You know, their hymn book, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their hymn book growing up, their set of worship songs as children would have been the Psalms. And Psalm 119:11 says, I have hidden your word in my heart that I might not sin against you. And they probably sang that as children. And now, imprisoned in captivity, they have done just that. They have hidden his word in their hearts. May we do the same, because it really serves them well here. See, they recognize that they can't do this. They cannot bow down and worship this statue. And so the conflict happens. In verses 8 through 12, and Logan read for us, we see that some of the astrologers go and bring this up to the king. They kind of tattle on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Let's read again verses 13 through 15. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? What God? What God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Who can save you from me? Furious, angry, the most powerful man in the world at this time asked them this question. And he knows what the answer is. The answer is no one. No one is more powerful than Nebuchadnezzar. No one can stop him, and no one can save them from his wrath. He has killed hundreds of thousands. He has destroyed civilizations, and he knows that the only thing that can keep them safe is to obey him. Who can save you? And that's the question I want us to sit on this morning. What keeps you safe? What keeps you safe? What makes you feel secure? How can you sleep soundly at night? I got a picture here. This is a safety net, okay? It's used by circus performers, acrobats when they walk the high wire right. Construction workers that work up high use it as well. And obviously, the idea is that if they fall, this will catch them. You know, acrobats train years to be able to walk the tightrope. But the safety net is the backup plan. It's in the case that something goes wrong, it's all okay because the safety net is there. We actually use this term, like safety net, to refer to kind of anything that takes care of us in tragic circumstances, right? You know, if some catastrophic event happened, what would keep your life together? If your house burned down, if a terrible illness left you unable to care for yourself, what's your safety net? Where would you turn? Maybe you would turn to family. Maybe you have family members who could take you in and care for you, and that's your safety net. Maybe it's your achievements. Maybe good grades would grant you the opportunities you need, or your reputation of success would cause people to give you another chance. Maybe you have friends that you can go to. But I think for most of us, our safety net has something to do with money. I think a lot of times that's the way we use this term, with money. You know, we have home insurance in case something happens to our home, and we have car insurance if we get in a wreck in our car. Of health insurance for when we're sick, life insurance for when we die, disability insurance if we can't work. Maybe we have some money saved up in the bank as kind of a safety net. You know, when Suzanne and I were young and married and fresh out of college, we went to a financial advisor, and he told us, he says, the first step is the umbrella of safety. okay? And what the umbrella of safety is to get all your insurance and all your safety nets in place so that if something bad happens, you'll be okay. And then you start deciding where you want to invest money and save money and that sort of thing. It's just a safety net, right? Dave Ramsey, he's the financial guru who has 7 baby steps for financial freedom. His first step is to start an emergency fund. And his third step is to make the emergency fund bigger, okay? These are safety nets, right? Those are 2 of his 7 steps. Make sure you have your safety nets in place. Everywhere you look, you can hear about the importance of having a safety net. Our high schoolers, as they prepare to graduate from high school, they sometimes talk about having a safety school, right? Here's the school I really want to get into, but if I don't, it's okay, because I have a safety school, I have a backup. It makes sense. It all makes sense. After all, if catastrophe strikes, what will be able to rescue you from its hand? Well, that's a familiar question, echoing King Nebuchadnezzar. And back in Daniel 3, we can kind of read and see how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respond. So I'm just going to read verses 16 through 18. As they respond to Nebuchadnezzar's question, what will be able to save you from me? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If the God we serve is able to deliver us, then he will deliver us from the blazing furnace and from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." I love this passage. It has become one of my favorite passages of Scripture over the years. They say, "Nebuchadnezzar, you're wrong. You think that you're the only safety, but you're wrong. There is someone who can save us from you. It's God." And they say, "Maybe he will, and maybe he won't. But whether he does or not, even if he does not save us, we will not betray him. We won't bow down." They have no safety net other than God. He is their only plan. He is their only hope. All of their hope is staked on God. C.S. Lewis, he wrote The Screwtape Letters. And if you haven't read into this book before, it's about this demon, Screwtape, and he's writing letters of advice to his nephew, Wormwood, trying to teach him how to tempt humans well. And Lewis wrote it with the intent of helping us understand how sin, like kind of how cunning and conniving sin is, so that we can be better prepared against it. And I have a quote I want to share. Screwtape, this demon writing to another demon, says, "Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never in more danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys." That's what we see with these 3 young men. They look around. Where's God? He's not clearly evident anywhere. There are a number of other safety nets that they could turn to, right? They're actually also some of the most powerful men in the world. The only people more powerful than them are Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. And so that means that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they have command of men and troops. They have a private guard. Maybe they can take their elite guard and escape and flee. Or surely their past service and achievements are worth something, right? Maybe they can convince Nebuchadnezzar to pardon them on this one thing based on their past accomplishments. Nebuchadnezzar makes a pretty strong case for being their safety net. He says, "No one can save you but me." I mean, can't they just bow down and in their hearts not actually worship the statue? They can ask God for forgiveness afterwards. They're only human. Surely he'll understand. But instead, they abandon every other recourse. They cast all their hopes onto God. No backup plans, no other safety nets. Whether God saves us or not, we will not bow. Now, a few years ago, I actually got to see some acrobats. This was at Winterfest. It's a youth group kind of convention we go to in Gatlinburg. We take our high schoolers. It's really awesome. There's like over 12,000 students there, and we worship together, and we get to hear speakers and dive into the Bible. And this one year, several years ago, the Flying Walindas were there. And they are this famous family of acrobats. They've been doing it 4 years. You may have heard about them through the years. We actually got to see them perform this stunt here. This is their seven-person pyramid on a high wire. And they've got someone on a chair balanced on this wire, balanced on people who are balanced on a wire. And they performed there in the Gatlinburg Conference Center, just high up above us in the air. And it was actually kind of terrifying. It was terrifying because they don't use safety nets, ever. They never use safety nets. And there was actually a moment when one of them stumbled, and it looked like they would all fall. And, I mean, people screamed. It was scary. But at the last second, he steadied himself, he calmed down, and they continued the performance. But there have been times in the past when they were not so fortunate. You can read through old articles about times when their family has fallen, people have gotten injured, and people have died. And so when those things have happened, I mean, they've been performing since the 60s, people ask, why? Why don't you use a safety net? And their response throughout the years has always been the same. They say that a safety net provides a false sense of security. A safety net provides a false sense of security. And it kind of reminds me of a parable that Jesus tells in Luke passage 12, or in Luke 12. If you'd like to turn over to that passage, you can. In Luke 12, this rich man brings in an exceptional harvest. It's more than he can even store. And so he tears down his old barns because they're not big enough. He says, I'll tear down the old ones, I'll build new ones, and I'll put all the surplus in that one. And I'm going to read verse 19 of Luke 12, because listen to what he says. This is great. He says to himself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. He has got his safety net. He is set. Now he can sleep easy at night. Except that God immediately responds, you fool, you aren't going to sleep easy tonight. You're going to die tonight. What a waste. What an unreliable safety net. And I think this gets to the heart of the problem with safety nets. That it's like the Flying Walindas point out, the sense of security they give really, in the end, is false. That they are not as secure as Babylon would have us believe. Our best backup plans will fail. People will let us down. There are problems money cannot solve. And too often, it seems those are the moments when all our backup plans fail, when we finally look to God. After all of our other attempts to save ourselves have fallen through, everything else we've built our hope on has failed. You know, we sing this song here, Cornerstone. It's a beautiful song. I think we're going to sing it today. It goes, my hope is built on nothing less than backup plans and insurance. Wow. No, we don't sing that. That's ridiculous, right? That would be silly to sing. We sing, my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. See, that is something that you can be secure in. Jesus, he's the one who you can really build your hope and your life on. I think it's true that only when we're without safety nets do we experience the amazing depths of God's ability to provide. See, it's when we have no other recourse that we get to see what God can really do in our lives. Only when we're totally abandoned to him do we discover the full wealth of his resources. Dallas Willard has this great quote. He says, the cautious faith that never saws off the limb on which it is sitting, never learns that unattached limbs may find strange, unaccountable ways of not falling. Now, some of you know this truth much better than I do. And I love getting to hear stories about how different people here are stepping out in faith, despite a lack of safety nets, to follow God's lead. Kevin has talked a few months back about Miss Kathy's Place, where Greg and Kathy Pauley are serving the children of an underprivileged trailer park. And the youth group got to go last month and play with the kids, and we're going again tomorrow, actually. And I can tell you firsthand, they did not move there because of how secure their lives would be, right? But who needs a safety net? Who needs a safety net when the God of all creation is leading the way? And that's what we see here in Daniel 3. And we can turn back to Daniel chapter 3, and we'll kind of see how the story plays out. Nebuchadnezzar is furious. It says he contorts his face in anger. He heats the furnace 7 times hotter than normal. And in fact, the men who go and drop Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the furnace, they die just from getting close enough to drop them in. Nebuchadnezzar, he looks inside, and instead of 3 people, he sees 4. Now, I think it's worth noting that God does not show up and rescue them right before they fall into the fire, right? Instead, he's there with them in the flames. It's in the fire that God shows up and rescues them. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they walk out of the fire unharmed. Nebuchadnezzar goes from saying, "No God can save you," to saying, "No God saves the way yours does." And so I think it is worth this morning carefully examining what we put our trust and our hope in. And where do we really build our hope, build our lives on? I think it's good to think about, where do we put our money? Where do we invest our time? What do our relationships look like? What opportunities do we say yes to, and what opportunities have we turned down? Now, I'm not trying to say that we should all go out and cancel our insurance. I would be a terrible person to take that kind of financial advice from, okay? But I am saying that if we never step out in faith into situations that require us to rely on God alone without any other safety net, we will never experience the full depth of his ability to provide for us. As we close, I'd like to go again to verses 16 through 18, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego make this amazing proclamation to the most powerful man in the world. They say, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves from you in this matter. If the God we serve is able to deliver us, then he will deliver us from the blazing furnace and from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Man, that's so good. Let's read it one more time. "Everyone's taking control of me. Seems that the world's got a role for me. I'm so confused. Will you show to me? You'll be there for me and care enough to bear me." Okay, those aren't the words of Daniel 3. They're the final words to "Will You Be There" by Michael Jackson, which you may know from the film Free Willy. And I don't want to over-spiritualize Michael Jackson's words here. I don't know what he meant by them. But I think that they fit into Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's story. See, these 3 young men, they find themselves in a world where everyone expects them to cling to the same safety nets that everyone else does. For them, they were expected to cling to the safety of the king, of obedience to Nebuchadnezzar. For us, it may also be that our safety net is the powers that be, or it may be wealth or influence, whatever it is you're tempted to put your hope in and to build your life on. And they look around, they say, there's got to be something better, someone better. There is someone better, someone more secure to trust in. And they were right. And if you are wondering if there is something more secure than the unreliable safety nets that the world offers, yes, there is. There is someone who will be there for you. There is someone who will bear you. He will bear all your mistakes, all your sins. He did bear them to the cross. He defeated death and sin because of his love for you. He will never let you down. He will never abandon you. He is secure, and you can build your life, build your hope on Jesus. This morning, we would love to be an encouragement to you to do that. And there will be people in the back who would love to talk or pray with you. If you have not placed all your hope in Jesus, if you want to do that this morning and put him on baptism, we'd love to help you with that as well. Let's stand up as we sing about our hope in Jesus.